Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there. I'm Michael Isikoff, substituting this week for Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
Tonight, the accused mastermind of the 9/11 terror attacks and two other defendants striking plea deals with prosecutors that will allow them to avoid the death penalty.
Nearly 23 years after the worst terrorist attack in American history, there is stunning news. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11 and two co-defendants, have agreed to plead guilty to the murder of 2,976 people that day as part of a plea deal in which they will be spared the death penalty. It's an extraordinary end to a seemingly endless legal drama that had dragged on in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba for decades. But will this plea bargain, which may be formally entered into court as early as next week, bring justice for the families of the 9/11 victims, especially as new evidence emerges in just recent weeks suggesting that the U.S. government and the public at large still hasn't gotten the full story of how the 9/11 attacks happened and all of those who were responsible. We'll talk to Brett Eagleson, the president of 9/11 Justice, a nonprofit that has advocated for the families, to get his perspective on this episode of Spy Talk. Brett Eagleson, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Sure. Pretty stunning news out of the Pentagon late Wednesday that this plea deal has been reached. On the one hand, it brings these seemingly endless military commission proceedings in Cuba to an end. On the other hand, the guy responsible for the deaths of nearly 3,000 people escapes the death penalty. Your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a sense of betrayal amongst the 9/11 family members right now. We weren't consulted in any way on what was going to be happening down in Guantanamo. When this prospect of a plea deal bubbled up a few months ago, we criticized it quite harshly. We weighed in with the White House. We said, don't do a deal unless you consult with the families and we have an opportunity to hear what these individuals have to say. These individuals have assuredly a lot of information. And the problem with the plea deal is that it avoids a trial. And we as Americans, especially Americans of victims, Americans who are victims of terror, deserve our basic American right of justice, and we deserve a trial. So what a plea deal does is it takes 9/11, it puts it in a little box, it wraps a bow on it, and it puts it on a shelf, and it makes it so our government officials don't have to deal with this uncomfortable issue anymore of Guantanamo and there's torture and all the other things that are related. And I think that why is a trial so important to us? Because I'll point you to what happened yesterday in the Southern District Court, the Southern Federal Court in Manhattan. We had a groundbreaking day where we've received numerous new bits of information about what led to the 9/11 attacks, and we got all that information from a trial. So,
Brett, I wanna dig into that, but let's just sort of wrap up the part about the plea deal first. You say families were not consulted prior to the release of this statement yesterday from the Pentagon saying the plea deal had been breached. Have you been briefed since about how this is going to work, when the plea deal will be entered? Will the families, victims have an opportunity to speak at the sentencing? What have you been told since this came out?
Well, I can only speak for myself, and I do speak to a lot of family members. My mom gets the letters from the Department of Justice. She's on their email list. I've seen everything that she's received. I've talked to fellow family members. I was with 500 of them yesterday. Not a single one of them has any more information than you and I do right now. And I can't say that there isn't one or two family members who the DOJ, maybe the CYA, they've pulled aside and said, hey, this is what we're going to do. So personally, and everybody I've spoken to has no idea how this will unfold. We don't know what types of questions we can ask. We don't know whether the information that they give to us is going to be able for us to be utilized in any capacity. This deal came out as a surprise yesterday. I found out about it when you found out about it, when, you know, the media started flagging it all over the place that a deal had been reached.
As part of the deal, according to the statement from the Pentagon, KSM and the two other co-defendants in this deal, Waleed bin Attash and Mustafa al-Hawsawi, have agreed to answer questions from the victims' family members, quote, regarding their roles and reasons for conducting the September 11th attacks. What do you plan to ask them?
Well, my first reaction is, so what? Like, what is, I mean, like, these are scraps that our government is giving to us after the fact. What does it matter when a plea deal is done and the paperwork is signed and they already know and they already got what they wanted? Do we really trust, or can we really know what they tell us is not merely lip service? And what can we do with what they tell us? I can't bring my dad back. It's not going to help me get justice against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I'm not even sure that I'm going to partake, but, if I did, it would be probably along the lines of, how did it happen? Who pulled it off? The story that the American public has been told was that 19 individuals with no knowledge of English, no money, no idea how to fly a plane, no exposure to Western culture, were able to pull off this most this devastating attack, the most consequential attack in American history. And you know, the mainstream story is that they had no help from anybody. They did it all on their own. And I would ask them, how did they do it? Did they have additional help? Because what we've been seeing is they had a clear support network waiting for them. The hijackers had a support network waiting for them in Southern California when they arrived.
I want to get into that, but just a couple of thoughts as you were speaking. Is there any thought by you or other family members or your lawyers of trying to stop this in any way?
It's so new. I did have a brief conversation with one of our attorneys yesterday, and the thought was, there's not much we can do. If the decision has already been made that they're going to get a plea deal, and a lot of what they say is tainted anyways. So it is a tricky situation, because I don't know that they would ever, if you went, you know, that's a hard question, Mike. I don't think there's any movement right now, at least I've heard of, to try to reverse this or stop this. I think that it is what it is, right, and we have to just proceed knowing that we're never going to.
And look, it is, you know, worth noting that this has been going on for decades. I mean, I covered the first arraignment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Guantanamo Bay in 2008. Now, he was captured in Pakistan in 2003. 5 years later, he's brought to Gitmo for the first time after, by the way, he was held in black sites and waterboarded 183 times, which made it, you know, once he arrived, trying to bring him to justice with the evidence of torture against him and others, made this a legal fiasco. I mean, there have been, the proceedings have been going on for years and years with no resolution in sight. I mean, some would say, look, given the recourse, given the length of this, that this is probably just the best that our government can do at this point.
I mean, I can't disagree on that, because if we went the long game here, how long would this have gone? Can they really put them to death with the whole taint of the torture? Personally, I don't really take a position on life versus death. It's impossible for me to pick, because I don't know their true wishes and their true intentions. For example, if they wanted to be martyrs, and if they wanted to be put to death, and if they were having a miserable existence, well, then I'd say let them rot away in a prison cell, right? But if they were somewhat at peace with their current life, and they were sort of, I don't know if enjoying is the best word, but if they were, living out the rest of their lives peacefully in Guantanamo, I would say, well, put them to death. So it's hard to answer the question without really knowing what they want, because whatever they want, I want to do the opposite.
Right, right. Well, it's clear they wanted to enter into a plea deal, because they did. I should just point out, my own sort of personal observations on this. And I was thinking of this very morning, because we just got news that the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who's been held in a prison cell in Moscow, was just released as part of a deal with the Russian government of Vladimir Putin. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was not just responsible for the death of your father and nearly 3,000 others. He also personally beheaded another Wall Street Journal reporter, Daniel Pearl, in 2002. And I remember talking to a senior U.S. government official shortly after that who had seen the video of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed with his own hand beheading Daniel Pearl. And this U.S. government official, who was committed to the rule of law, said, "I don't care, just kill him." That was his emotional reaction to watching Khalid Sheikh Mohammed personally killing the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I, as you can imagine, in 2002, I was 16 years old, and I wasn't aware of that until you just told me. So,
yeah, it's part of the record on this, and it's just another reason people are going to have this, are going to find this difficult to process.
I mean, it evokes strong feelings. It's tough. It's right. Tough.
Speaking of which, we should point out, your own personal role in this. Your father, Bruce, was on the 17th floor of the World Trade Towers that horrible day, September 11th, 2001, working for the Westfield Group, the commercial shopping mall company. He made it down to the ground floor, and then, discovering that authorities were having trouble communicating, he went back up to retrieve two-way radios to help authorities get people out of the building. Tell us about your father.
Yeah, he was a fantastic father, a role model to me. He still is a role model. I often think of what he would do in my current situations, especially as it relates to raising my kids. He had a tremendous amount of patience. Everybody seemed to like him, and just he was a natural born leader. So it's no surprise to me that he stayed behind to try to help and lend his hand in those evacuation efforts. It's bittersweet. It's tough and challenging, because he could have and should have walked out those doors. He had every opportunity to walk out those lobby doors and be fine. So there's the selfish part of me that thinks, Dad, why didn't you just say screw it and come home? So that's the hard part. But, you know, that's the bitter part. But the sweet part is that he's being memorialized as a hero. And here we are, you know, 23 years later talking about him. And, you know, people are still talking about him. And his story is now known. So I think that's an honor to him. And I think he would be proud of that legacy.
I'm sure he would be. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back. All right, let's talk about the lawsuit, which you have been heavily involved in for years now. This is a lawsuit brought by family members against the government of Saudi Arabia for its alleged role in facilitating and sponsoring the events of that day, or at least some officials of the Saudi government. Yesterday was a big day in this lawsuit that has dragged on just as long as those military commission proceedings against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because this was the day you went before a federal judge, Judge Daniels, in New York, in the Southern District, and argued against the Saudi government effort to have your lawsuit dismissed. Tell us about the hearing yesterday and what you learned.
That's right. This is their second time that they've tried to have this case dismissed. They first tried to have this case dismissed in 2017, shortly after we filed our initial lawsuit. And based on the evidence that we had at that time, even the small amount of evidence that we had at that time, Judge Daniels had said, no, I'm not going to dismiss this. There's enough credibility there to have this lawsuit persist into a limited discovery phase. So we were granted limited discovery in 2017. That's where we've really started to dig into what happened and the support networks. And that's where we ran into a lot of trouble with our own government, right? I think I've spoken to you in the past about having to fight the DOJ and having to fight the FBI and having to fight Donald Trump and his invocation of state secrets on all of these documents that our government had, which we now have thanks to a presidential executive order by Biden that showed the complicity of Saudi Arabia. So in 2017, we filed suit. They tried to get us dismissed. We won. Since then until now, we've been in discovery fighting the kingdom of Saudi Arabia and fighting our own government for these materials. Discovery officially ended, and the kingdom has said, okay, they've had enough time, game's over, they don't have anything. And they're trying to reintroduce their motion to dismiss. Yesterday was such a groundbreaking day for us because we had 500 family members. It was actually very moving. 500 family members filing into multiple overflow rooms in the Southern District. And it's the first time that these family members and the media at large have heard our entire case completely laid out, untethered, unmasked, totally exposed. There was no protective orders at play yesterday. We learned of new evidence. We learned that Omar El-Bayoumi, who is the subject of this video where he's filming the U.S. Capitol and targeting the Capitol and casing the U.S. Capitol in the summer of 1999, Omar El-Bayoumi is somebody the FBI has described as an individual working for Saudi intelligence. He's feeding information to the Saudi intelligence. Some folks have claimed that he's an agent working for Saudi intelligence. And the kingdom has always said that Omar El-Bayoumi was acting on his own. You know, he was a lower level employee. Sure, he was working with a couple of other Saudi government officials, but it was in their capacity. It wasn't in any bigger type of capacity. There was no conspiracy here. There was no structure or hierarchy. Well, yesterday, we totally blew that theory, that argument out of the water, because for the first time, we saw that prior to the hijackers' arrival, there were two more senior Saudi government officials, Sudan and Sudairi, working for the Ministry of Islamic Affairs, that came months before the hijackers, and they charted a path of when they landed at LAX to a safe house, then to a mosque, then to another series of safe houses. And that is the exact path that the hijackers took when they landed months later. So there was a dry run done before the hijackers arrived, and that dry run was performed by two more senior Saudi government officials. And Omar al-Bayoumi and these senior Saudi government officials had numerous back and forth phone calls and interactions with each other prior to their arrival and even after their arrival. So that's something new. That's something new that we all
that is new. And I want to dig in a little to that. We should point out that Bayoumi is the guy who meets two of the hijackers, Khaled al-Madar and al-Hazmi, at the Mediterranean Cafe in LA, supposedly by chance, takes them in, brings them to San Diego, gets an apartment for them, sets them up with a bank account, introduces them to a whole network of people in San Diego while they're here in the United States planning for the September 11th attack. And this video with those two guys you mentioned, Sadari and al-Sudan, is new. Just released, I think your lawyers got them from British authorities because Bayoumi had gone to the UK after September 11th. And it does show an apparent casing of the U.S. Capitol, security procedures in the U.S. Capitol, landmarks in the U.S. And what's remarkable is I covered all the investigations, including the 9/11 Commission investigation into the 9/11 attacks that was supposed to be the final word, and they didn't have this video. We've got a clip of Michael Morell, who was the former deputy director of the CIA, being interviewed on Face the Nation just a couple of weeks ago after he had watched this video, seen it for the first time, said it was unquestionably, in his mind, a casing video. Let's listen to that clip, and I'd like to get your reaction, Brett.
The FBI concluded he was not a threat. The 9/11 Commission report concluded he was not a threat. You're saying it's clear he was al-Qaeda and living under the noses and examination of law enforcement undetected. He's now living in Saudi Arabia as we speak. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty big oversight by U.S. law enforcement and intelligence. Did the CIA know about this video?
We did not. You know, I'm 99.9% confident that we did not have this video. I was the president's briefer at the time. If somebody had shown me this video, I would have shown it to the president.
That's a pretty amazing comment from the former deputy director of the CIA, an acknowledgement that an apparent crucial piece of evidence about the worst terrorist attack in American history was not known to the CIA. Yep. Not known to the federal commission set up to investigate the attacks.
Mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. You could argue that this individual, the former deputy director of the CIA, that there was not many people that had a higher security clearance than him. There was not many people who were more important than him in terms of our national security. And how can it be that he's never seen the video? Well, the 9/11 commission certainly never saw the video. And, you know, they've made the 9/11 Commission has made conclusions based on the evidence they've seen. And since the 9/11 Commission, we've had troves of new documents that they've never seen. And a lot of what I heard yesterday in court was the kingdom continuing to cite the 9/11 Commission, the 9/11 Commission. And they sort of use the findings of the commission for this faux exoneration of their role. And they kept relying upon the 9/11 Commission because they don't have any good answers to this. They see the video and they characterize it as a tourist video. Now, you and I have both been to many places and we've probably shot what we would consider tourist videos. And I've never said, my esteemed brothers and sisters, I'm reporting to you live from such and such place and the time is 6:02 p.m. And I'm going to report back to you later when I figure out what's going on over there. And I don't film structural supports of buildings and the egresses and ingresses. And by the way, he's referring to senators and demons. You know, if I'm
when they show the Capitol, he refers to the people there as demons. This is Bayoumi.
Yeah.
And you know, you mentioned the reliance of the lawyers for Saudi Arabia on the 9/11 Commission attacks. And just to put this in a little bigger context, you know, if there was a support network for the hijackers in the United States, which is the thrust of your lawsuit, that the Saudi government or
elements within the government, yeah,
some officials in the Saudi government were part of a sponsored a support network. Bayoumi is the key player in that. He's the guy that meets the hijackers after, you know, in regular communication with, among others, Anwar al-Awlaki, who would later became the head of the al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen and was killed by a U.S. drone strike approved by President Obama's administration. Bayoumi is key. So going back to the 9/11 Commission, I dug out my copy last night in preparation for this interview. And here's what they say about Bayoumi, that he was a business student in the United States, supported by a private contractor for the Saudi Civil Aviation Authority. And they described him as a devout Muslim who spent much of his spare time involved in religious study and helping to run a mosque. We have seen no credible evidence that he believed in violent extremism or knowingly aided extremist groups. We do know that as far as him being a business student, the FBI, under Operation Encore, which they launched after the 9/11 Commission had completed its findings, concluded that he was actually a co-optee of Saudi intelligence. He was there as a Saudi intelligence agent to report and keep tabs on Saudis in Southern California and reported directly to Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador from Saudi Arabia at the time. And his multiple communications with multiple people with extremist al-Qaeda links, including al-Awlaki.
Yeah, and what we heard yesterday in court was that he hosted all of these individuals, all these members of the Islamic community, the most radical, violent extremists. He hosted at his house as a welcome party. So when the hijackers first moved from one apartment to the other, Bayoumi was sort of the MC, the organizer of this party. And he's going around the room introducing all of these radical extremists who nobody denies, by the way. He was introducing them as the special to the hijackers and referring to the hijackers in a form of Arabic as a very respectable term. So everybody in that room knew that these two hijackers were destined for something. They may have not known the plan, but they knew that these two hijackers were very here on a mission, I think is the words that I've heard.
That is the key unanswered question here, because even Morrell in that interview acknowledged, we don't know, even with all the evidence that the FBI was able under Operation Encore and your lawyers were able to get, we still don't know if they knew, if Bayoumi and the other people who were helping him in Southern California, including the imam at the King Fahd Mosque, Thumairi, who was a known radical extremist and was barred by the State Department from coming back into the United States for that reason. We don't know that they knew what al-Madar and al-Hazbi had been sent here to do.
Well, I think that we can say that we knew that Bayoumi knew that they were here to do harm. I don't know that if they knew that they were going to hijack flight such and such and crash it into the Pentagon, but they were clearly here for a reason. They were given direction. Bayoumi was given direction from higher ups within the Saudi government to take care of these individuals, to make sure that they had all the resources that they needed. And as we're learning more with Bayoumi casing the U.S. Capitol and targeting the Capitol, you know, is the truth starting to become clearer that maybe Bayoumi did in fact know? And in the video, I should point out, Bayoumi is referring to the plan. And there's multiple segments within the casing video that he's referencing the plan. Well, I wonder what that plan is.
Right, right. So where do things go from here? Judge Daniels now has to make a decision about whether to grant the Saudi motion to dismiss your lawsuit, or alternatively, if presumably discovery gets to proceed further, and is there any prospect of a trial anytime in the foreseeable future? What happens now?
Well, it's all in Daniels' hands right now. The ball is in his court. He has been briefed on both sides. It is up to him to make a decision as to whether or not there is enough merit and credibility for this case to move forward. In that event, the Saudis' motion to dismiss would be denied, plaintiffs would win, and we would be looking at full-blown discovery. We would look into all the other cells that operated all over the country, like, you know, Virginia and Florida, and I believe there was even some out in the Midwest. So the kingdom, we feel, would be under a tremendous amount of pressure at that point. You know, the kingdom really hates this lawsuit. They, from a PR standpoint, they want to get rid of this as fast as they can. So I think that would be a huge win for us. On the contrary, if Daniels decides that, you know, the law that we've passed, JASTA, doesn't apply, or that there's not enough evidence and we do get dismissed, well, that would be pretty devastating to us. And of course, we would appeal that. I think either side is going to appeal whatever decision's made. So a decision could come any day, or it can come in a year from now. We really have no idea. You know, for example, Daniels, is when he had this motion to dismiss in front of him the first time, that was a seven month decision period. So I'm not hopeful that we're going to get a decision tomorrow on this, right, but I hope it won't take seven months either.
And it sounds like either way, we're a long way away from resolution, because as you pointed out, if he dismisses the Saudi motion, you don't go directly to trial, you get more discovery. Right. And, you mentioned looking at other cells. One central player who knows more about what the Saudi operations in the United States than anybody is Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador at the time. You did not get to depose him, but I would imagine that if discovery is allowed to proceed, he would be towards the top of the list.
That's right. He would be if he decides to comply, but I don't know that he would subject himself to that.
Yeah. Well, Brett, I want to thank you for taking the time today. I know it's been quite a whirlwind for you over the last 24 hours, but it sounds like this matter will be going on for still some time. So
we're going to keep fighting it, we're not going anywhere, and we're going to keep doing it until the end. So,
all right.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks a lot, Brett Eagleson. Really appreciate it. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analysis on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-Roe anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.